Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today, we're diving into a topic that has personally fascinated me for years. Anime swords.
Exactly. And we're not just talking about random weapons that happen to appear in animated series. This goes much deeper.
Because in Japanese anime, the sword often literally becomes the soul of a character. That's so different from Western productions. There, a sword is usually, well, a tool, practical, interchangeable.
That's a good way to put it. In Japan, a connection between sword and identity developed over centuries that's quite unique. The samurai class turned the sword into an important status symbol, most prominently during the Edo period, even though bows and spears were more important in early combat. But it wasn't just that.
What else?
It became an extension of one's personality. There's Shintoism in there, the idea that objects can be ensouled, and Zen Buddhism with its emphasis on meditative perfection. The smiths performed rituals back then, prayed to gods. The sword wasn't simply an object created in a workshop.
That explains why anime series treat it so differently from Hollywood. In Western films, you smash the sword into someone's face, done. Brutal, realistic, physical.
And in anime, you see acrobatic fights, energy waves, supernatural powers. The sword becomes a channel for the character's inner strength.
Take Bleach as an example. The Shinigami swords are called Zanpakuto, and they literally represent the soul of the wielder. You develop as a character, and your sword develops with you.
When it comes to fantasy elements in anime, that's particularly
exciting! Inuyasha's Tesaiga, for example. The sword can defeat demons, transform itself. It's an heirloom from his father. There's family history in there. Identity. Power.
You beat me to it.
Sorry, but I get really enthusiastic when it comes to anime swords.
And rightfully so. What fascinates me is this tension between historical accuracy and complete fantasy. Some series, like Rurouni Kenshin, make an effort with historical details. Kenshin's sword shows not only his abilities as a fighter, but also his commitment to never kill again.
So the sword as a moral compass.
Exactly. And then, on the other side, you have Berserk with the Dragon Slayer. A sword so huge and heavy that nobody could actually swing it in real life. But it symbolizes Guts' indomitable will.
And it works, even though it's physically impossible. Because it's not about realism, it's about emotional truth.
That's perhaps the core difference. Hollywood shows you what happens physically. Anime shows you what happens emotionally. And the sword becomes the metaphor.
That's why there's such variety. You have the classic katana with its curved blade, optimized for drawing cuts. Then the nodachi, extra long to demonstrate strength. The wakizashi as a shorter companion. And then completely invented swords, like Excalibur in Fate's Day Night.
The Arthurian legend interpreted Japanese style.
With saber as the wielder. The sword stands for royal dignity and heroism. A European legend, viewed through a Japanese anime lens.
Which shows how universal this sword symbolism really is. Honor, power, spiritual values. It works across cultures.
But Japan has this special tradition of bringing it all together. Character development is often directly tied to the sword. The hero grows, his sword grows with him. Or he has to prove himself worthy first.
That comes from samurai culture. The combination of katana and wakizashi, the daisho, symbolized status and honor. You weren't just someone with two swords, you were a samurai. That defined you.
And anime picked that up and spun it further, in a direction that's no longer historically accurate, but emotionally absolutely spot on.
We'll come back to that in more detail. The history of Japanese swords, how the katana developed, what variants exist.
And the specific examples from different series. There's so much material. Let's take a step back in history. Before the katana even existed, there were completely different swords in Japan.
The chokuto, straight blades, single-edged, heavily influenced by Chinese and Korean models. We are talking about the Kofun period here, roughly 250 to 538 AD.
And these straight swords weren't just thrusting weapons. You could thrust with them, but also slash. The Japanese initially imported swordsmithing from the mainland, influenced by continental models from China and Korea.
Which worked at first, but then something crucial changed.
Warfare. From the 10th century onwards, cavalry became increasingly important. Mounted warriors fighting from above. And the smiths realized a straight sword on horseback is, well, impractical.
Because you can't thrust properly?
Among other things. But mainly because you can't use the horse's momentum. When you strike from horseback, you need a drawing cut. The blade should glide through the target, not just hack into it. And a curve is perfect for that.
The curve as leverage.
The curvature creates a natural cutting angle. You pull the blade through as you gallop past. The tachi, which emerged in the 10th century, had this gentle bend called sori. Initially, it sat close to the grip, so the cutting angle was optimal.
And that was truly revolutionary. In Europe at the same time, straight swords predominantly dominated. Curved blades only really came into fashion later, especially through Ottoman influence.
Japan was ahead of the curve there, so to speak. The tachi became the standard weapon of early samurai. Longer blade, worn with the edge facing down on hangers, suitable for combat on horseback.
And from this tradition then developed
the different sword types. Katana, wakizashi, tanto. They mainly differ in length.
Which is often confusing for non-experts. I always explain it like this. The katana is the main sword, about 60 to 73 centimeters blade length. The wakizashi is the little brother, roughly 30 to 60 centimeters. And the tanto is essentially a dagger, under 30 centimeters.
The functions were completely different. The katana for open combat, the wakizashi for tight spaces or as a backup weapon. And for seppuku, the tanto was traditionally used for that, later also the wakizashi.
And as mentioned, the samurai later wore katana and wakizashi together, the daisho.
But also practical, two blade lengths for different combat situations.
By the way, if this topic fascinates you as much as it does us, feel free to subscribe and share the episode. That really helps us dive even deeper into topics like this.
Back to the swords. What impresses me again and again is the tradition. The basic principle of the curved, single-edged sword was preserved for centuries, even though details like curvature and length certainly changed over time.
Because the basic principle worked. The smiths changed quite a bit over the centuries. From the longer tachi, starting in the 10th century for mounted samurai, to the shorter katana from the 14th century for foot combat. But the single-edged curved sword remained.
In Europe, sword forms changed dramatically. From the Viking sword to the long sword to the rapier. In Japan, the evolution was more subtle, but definitely there. From tachi to katana, the curvature changed. The blade width, even the point shape.
The sword was more than a tool there. It was sacred. But interestingly, that didn't stop the smiths from making technical improvements. The spiritual reverence existed alongside constant refinement.
The crafting process itself was almost a religious act, wasn't it?
The smiths performed purification rituals, prayed. They folded the blade made from tamahagane multiple times to homogenize the steel. The balance of hard edge and tough spine comes from differential hardening. That creates the hamon, that wavy line on the blade. It could take months for a single sword.
And this tradition is reflected in anime. The reverence for the sword. The idea that every blade has its own, personality.
Which brings us to our next point. Samurai culture connected this technical development with an entire philosophy. The samurai, a warrior class that shaped Japan for over 700 years. From the 12th to the 19th century, they were the elite, wielding military and political power.
And the sword was their trademark. In no other culture was the connection between warrior and weapon so ritualized.
What's interesting is, the reality was often different from the romantic image. When we talk about samurai today, many think of the noble warrior with his code of honor. But the term Bushido, the way of the warrior, was only formally coined relatively late.
How late?
The systematic codification only came in the 17th century, during the Tokugawa period. And the term really became popular through Nitobe Inazo, who wrote a book for Western readers in 1900, Bushido, the Soul of Japan.
So, after the actual samurai era had ended.
The samurai as a class were officially abolished in 1876. That means much of what we know today as Bushido is a, well, retrospective idealization. The seven virtues, Gi, Yu, Jin, Rei, Makoto, Meiyo, Chugi, were only systematically compiled later.
That explains a lot about anime portrayals. They work with this romanticized image, not with historical reality.
Although that doesn't mean samurai had no sense of honor.
Of course they had values, but they were more pragmatic. Loyalty to the daimyo, to the lord, martial arts, hierarchy. Not always this noble black and white from the series.
The reality was often brutal and opportunistic. During the Sengoku period, the era of warring states, samurai regularly switched sides. Loyalty was negotiable.
But the sword itself, that actually did have this spiritual dimension, regardless of how individual samurai behaved.
The tachi, originally the combat weapon of mounted samurai, was also used as an offering in Shinto shrines. Swords were considered dwelling places of kami, of gods or spirits. That's no exaggeration.
Oh, that's the point. The sword as a sacred object, not just a weapon.
And this spiritual aspect, which we touched on earlier, was inseparably linked to the crafting process.
How many layers of steel were actually processed?
It varied, but the smith would fold the steel over and over, 10, 15 times, sometimes more. Each fold doubles the layers. You quickly get to thousands of layers.
That explains the famous patterning on the blades.
The hara, yes. Every blade has its own pattern, almost like a fingerprint. And then there's the hardening line, the hamon. That's created during differential hardening, when the spine stays softer than the edge.
Hardness for sharpness, flexibility against breaking. A compromise perfected over centuries.
And precisely this craftsmanship has been preserved in anime portrayals. The reverence for the sword. We see it in series like Rurouni Kenshin or Demon Slayer.
In Demon Slayer, it's particularly clear. Every blade has its own coloring that matches the wielder.
A fantasy version of the historical concept. But the basic idea that the sword reflects the wielder's soul, that's authentic.
Even if the specific details are invented.
The anime creators draw on the romanticized Bushido, not on historical sources. But in doing so, they hit an emotional core that works.
Now it gets really interesting. Anime swords, where historical models meet pure creativity.
What strikes me about this, anime artists often know their source material surprisingly well. The katana with its curved blade, the long grip for two-handed handling, it's all accurate.
And then they take this foundation and go completely wild. The Nodachi, for example, an independent Japanese longsword related to the katana, but significantly longer. Historically, it was already a challenge to wield a blade over 1 meter long.
They were used on the battlefield. Infantry wielded them two-handed for wide horizontal strikes, and some ended up as temple offerings. The anti-cavalry theory? That mainly appears in commercial sources. It's not historically documented.
But in anime, the Nodachi becomes a statement. Sephiroth in Final Fantasy, Sesshomaru in Inuyasha. Whoever carries an oversized sword demonstrates superhuman strength and control.
It works visually. You immediately see this character is different.
The Wakizashi, on the other hand, plays a more subtle role. In historical context, it was the companion sword, the backup. In anime series, it's often used for tight spaces or quick dagger attacks, or as a sign of pragmatism.
Who doesn't carry a large sword, but a short one?
Assassins, ninja, characters who rely on speed rather than brute strength. The Wakizashi becomes a characterization tool.
When it comes to magical properties, things get
completely crazy. Tesaiga from Inuyasha is the perfect example. A sword forged from the fang of a demon dog.
And it can transform.
It absorbs abilities from defeated opponents, can break barriers, release energy waves. At rest, it looks like a rusty old blade. But in battle, it becomes huge and crystalline.
That's as far from any historical sword as possible. And yet, it works.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
Because it makes narrative sense. The Tesaiga is an heirloom from Inuyasha's father. It grows with the character, learns new abilities when Inuyasha overcomes personal hurdles. The sword is literally a mirror of his development.
That's the emotional logic that anime masters so well. It doesn't have to be physically possible. It has to feel right.
And then, of course, there are the extremes. The Dragon Slayer from Berserk.
That thing that looks like a raw chunk of metal someone forgot to finish forging?
Bigger than the wielder. Guts lugs this monster around that's so heavy it would be physically, well, impossible.
A real two-hander weighs maybe 3-4 kilos. The Dragon Slayer at those proportions would have to be
easily 50 kilos or more. And Guts swings that thing with one hand.
Which is, of course, the point. The Dragon Slayer symbolizes his indomitable will, his refusal to give up, no matter how overpowering the enemy.
The sword is too big, too heavy, too crude. Just like the challenges Guts has to overcome. It's a visual metaphor.
And that's why it works emotionally, even though any physicist would shake their head.
Fate's Day Night then goes in a different direction again. There we have Excalibur, Western mythology, interpreted Japanese style.
The Arthurian legend.
Saber, who is actually King Arthur, wields Excalibur as the ultimate weapon. The sword stands for royal dignity, for the right to rule, for self-sacrifice.
And the Japanese have merged that with their own sword philosophy. The holy sword as an extension of the soul.
Excalibur's special attack releases all magical energy, an all-or-nothing moment. That fits Saber's character, her willingness to give everything for her duty.
In Naruto, there are the seven swordsmen of the mist. Each sword has its own abilities. Samahada absorbs chakra, Kubikiri Bocho regenerates through blood.
These aren't weapons in the classic sense anymore. They're characters with their own personalities.
That fits the Shintoism concept we mentioned at the beginning. The belief that objects can be ensouled. The anime creators translate that into fantasy mechanics.
The range is fascinating. From the semi-realistic katana to the physically impossible colossus. But they all follow the same basic rule. The sword tells something about its wielder.
That's probably the common thread. No matter how crazy the design, the symbolism remains. What makes anime swords so special isn't the action. It's the meaning behind it.
The sword as a mirror. What the character carries says something about their soul.
Rurouni Kenshin is the perfect example of this. Kenshin Himura was Hitokiri Batosai, a feared assassin during the Bakumatsu period. He killed people. Many.
And then he carries a Sakabato, a sword with a reversed blade.
The sharp side faces inward, the blunt side outward. He can fight with it, but not kill. The sword is his vow. Every time he draws it, it reminds him of who he no longer wants to be.
That's so elegant. You don't need exposition, no internal monologue. You see the sword and understand the character.
Anime writers use the sword as shorthand for complex inner states. In Bleach, this goes even further. The Zanpakuto are literally manifested souls.
Every Shinigami has their own Zanpakuto, and it has its own spirit, its own personality. You have to communicate with your sword, learn its name, to unleash its full power.
That's no longer a metaphor. The sword is part of you. When you develop, the sword develops. When you are internally torn, the Zanpakuto reflects that inner conflict.
That explains so much. The emotional impact comes from our instinctive understanding. What happens to the sword happens to the character's soul.
The theme of inheritance, which we briefly touched on with Inuyasha, takes on a deeper dimension here. The Tesaiga isn't just any heirloom. It connects Inuyasha to his deceased father, whom he never really knew.
Every time Inuyasha uses the sword, it's a connection to that father figure. The sword becomes an emotional anchor.
And that works because...
because we all know that longing. Maintaining a connection to someone who's no longer there through an object.
That's universal. In Western mythology, we have similar concepts. Excalibur legitimizes Arthur as king. Durendal, Roland's sword, doesn't even break when he dies. The sword outlasts the wielder, carries their story forward.
Is that why sword symbolism works across cultures?
That's an interesting question. I think it's because the sword is so fundamental. It's an extension of the arm, of the will. You decide when to draw it, whom to point it at.
In Sword Art Online, Kirito carries his sword as a symbol of justice and friendship. In a virtual world where everything is digital, the sword becomes the only genuine expression of his values.
The Naruto swords of the Seven Swordsmen work differently. There, it's the legends surrounding the weapons that define their wielders. Whoever carries one of these swords becomes part of a tradition, a chain of warriors.
The sword as burden and honor at the same time.
These romanticized samurai ideals, the notion that the sword reflects inner worth, live on in modern anime. The authors take this tradition and translate it for a contemporary audience.
That's why it touches us emotionally. It's not just cool animated action. These are stories about identity, heritage, moral choices. The sword makes these abstract concepts tangible.
A character can put down their sword, let it break, find a new one. Each of these actions has narrative meaning.
Or pass it on to the next generation.
The sword as a baton. The story continues, even when the original wielder is no longer there.
What impresses me most is how consistently anime writers employ this symbolism. Across genres, across decades, the sword remains the soul's mirror.
Because it works. Emotionally, narratively, visually. The sword tells stories that words alone cannot tell.
What a journey. From the straight chokuto of the Kofun period, through the curved tachi of the mounted samurai, to the completely oversized fantasy blades of modern anime.
Over 1,000 years of sword history condensed into animated stories that captivate people worldwide.
What I find particularly remarkable is this continuity. The Japanese anime creators embraced the tradition of their ancestors and translated it for a global audience. The reverence for the sword, the spiritual dimension, that's not an invention.
It comes from real rituals, real beliefs. The smiths who prayed before working. The samurai who regarded their blades as dwelling places for spirits.
And then this range of
expressions. From the narratively coherent but fictional Sakabato in Rurouni Kenshin to the physically impossible Dragon Slayer in Berserk. Anime allows both.
As we said at the beginning, it's not about realism. It's about emotional truth. The sword tells the story of the character, their struggles, their development.
And that confirms our point, it works across cultures. Excalibur in Fate's Day Night proves it. Western mythology seen through Japanese eyes, and suddenly we understand King Arthur in a new way.
For people who want to get into the topic, I'd say, watch a series and consciously pay attention to the swords. Rurouni Kenshin for the historical approach, Bleach for the spiritual dimension, Berserk for the raw emotional power.
Or start with the sword that appeals to you most and work your way from there. The story behind it is always richer than you'd think.
And for those who want to dig deeper, real samurai history is just as fascinating as the fiction. The forging techniques, the rituals, the philosophy.
The beautiful thing is that you can enjoy both. The historical reality and the artistic interpretation. They enrich each other.
The fascination won't fade. As long as people tell stories about honor, identity, and personal struggles, swords will play a role. They are too perfect as symbols.
An extension of the will. A tangible metaphor for inner strength.
And for fans and collectors, there's of course the opportunity to connect with these themes physically as well. A replica on the wall reminds you of the stories behind it.
By the way, on battlemerchant.com you'll find not only swords, but also plenty of other topics on the blog. If you're interested in Japanese culture, medieval history or fantasy, there's a lot to discover.
We hope you enjoyed this episode and perhaps gained a new perspective. You'll surely watch the next anime series with different eyes.
Pay attention to the swords. They tell more than you think.
That's it from us for today. Thank you so much for listening.
Until next time.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your swords sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.